It is customary for us to pause a few moments for silent prayer before beginning our class, and this will afford you the opportunity for rebound if necessary. Shall we pray? Father, we thank You for this opportunity to study truth. Our prayer is that the Holy Spirit would take the things we're about to examine and make them real to us, that it might be a part of our developing inventory of ideas, that what we study would contribute to that advance and ultimately to our capacity for not only blessings and reward, but also the ability to efficiently serve You. And we lift our prayers in Christ's name. Amen. We've had a few breaks of late, so I thought I would go back to verse 6 and review the translation as we have it so far. And verse 6 is where the Shulamite interrupts the aria of the king, and she interrupts with this comment here. Until this period of pressure is removed, I will retreat into my memory center, inspired by the aroma of my sachet, and recall principles of doctrine that give me courage and confidence. And then Solomon, completely self-possessed, continues his aria in verse 7. And he does so with pickup line number 14. You are altogether beautiful, my lover, and there is no blemish in you. Lover here has to do with the implication that she is going to be his sexual partner. Verse 8, pick up line number 15. Come with me from Lebanon, my bride. May you come with me from Lebanon. Journey down from the summit of Amana, from the summit of Senir and Hermon, from the dens of lions and from the mountains of leopards. We studied that in a little bit of detail and learned that that has to do with his retreat villas in the mountains. Verse 9, pick up line number 16. You have captured my heart, my Jewess, my wife. You have captured my heart with a single glance of your eyes, with a single strand of your necklace. Verse 10, pick up line number 17. How beautiful is your love, my sister, my bride. How much better is your love than wine, and the fragrance of your oils than all kinds of spices. Pick up line number 17 in an expanded translation would read this way. How beautiful is your love, my Jewess, my wife. Sex with you is more intoxicating than the effects of fine wine and the fragrance of your oils than all kinds of spices. Verse 10, pick up line number 18. Your lips, my wife, drip with the sweetness of honey. Under your tongue is an abundant reservoir of deep, passionate kisses. And then it continues with the pickup line number 19, and the fragrance of your garments is like the fragrance of Lebanon. Then we move to verse 12, pickup line number 20, and paraphrase, you are a protected virgin, my Jewess, my wife, whose womb is a locked garden, its spring of life sealed up within. We resume our study now with Song of Solomon 4, verse 13, pick up line number 21 in the New American Standard. It reads this way. Your shoots are an orchard of pomegranates, which with choice fruits, henna with nard plants. In case you missed that, you guys, I'll read that one again. Your shoots are an orchard of pomegranates with choice fruits, henna with nard plants. Point one. The word shoots is shalak, and it refers to plants. You'll notice down there nard plants. Well, shoots refers to plants, and you do the research, and that's what you discover. And Solomon expands on the metaphor he developed then in verse 12, which characterized the Shulamite's womb as a locked garden. Plants refer to the things that are cultivated in a garden, And they include flowers and vegetables, fruits, herbs, vines, even trees. And we will get into in a moment a definition of this garden. And it is from that definition that we're able to determine that Solomon has every intent of having sex with this woman. He's called her his lover. He's called her his Jewess. He's called her his wife. And he's spoken of her locked garden, which is very alluring to him. You are a protected virgin. That's the idea of the locked garden. Then he refers to her as my Jewess, my wife, whose womb is a locked garden, its spring of life sealed up within. Well, that clearly depicts her virginity. And then he is speaking of, in a metaphorical way, the kinds of, when you have a garden that is very replete in growth, that had a lot of water, a lot of rain, it is very prosperous. The word escapes me, but he looks on her as a prosperous field for sexual activity. And he's using metaphors of how flowers and vegetables and trees and what have you grow in a well-watered garden. So in his metaphor, Solomon imagines the pleasures he would acquire by entering the Shulamite's garden and harvesting its delights. This, of course, is poetry. It is put to music. And so you have a lot of innuendo, double entendres, and that kind of thing along the way. So he is looking on her womb as a garden, and he is going to break the lock, go in and harvest its delights. These plants therefore flourish in a beautiful setting, which Solomon now describes as an orchard. The Hebrew word is pardes. That's P-A-R-D-E-S. Pardes. And it refers actually to a park. It's not just any park, because this park is developed exclusively for the enjoyment of kings. And it is the root word for the English word paradise. Now, I want to give you some background on this word pardes. It gives us insight to its use by Solomon as a metaphor for the Shulamite's body. I've got three sources here. First of all, we note the Net Bible, page 1209. There is a study note at Song of Solomon 4:13, and it's discussing the word pardes. It is the noun that is translated garden, parkland, or forest. And note this, it is a foreign loan word that occurs only three times in the Hebrew Bible. Our passage, Ecclesiastes 2:5, also written by Solomon, and Nehemiah 2:8. Now, the original Old Persian term we have here, we go back to ancient Persian, and we have here paradisa is the word from the Persian, and that designated the enclosed parks and pleasure grounds, which were the exclusive domain of the Persian kings and nobility and the Achaemenid period. And that takes you back to Achaemenides, that he was a member of the ruling house of ancient Persia, generally considered historically important from the assumption of power by Cyrus the Great. That takes you back to ancient Persia, 559 B.C., to the overthrow of Darius III in 330 B.C. So this is a loan word that goes back to the 6th century B.C., and it is a Persian word. Now, I questioned that because we see it being popular between the reigns of these two Persian kings. Solomon is writing in the 10th century B.C., so apparently this word was used prior to this dynasty, and he is incorporating it into the Hebrew, and we note that he also used it in Ecclesiastes. Now, the Babylonian term pardesu means marvelous garden in reference to the enclosed parks of the kings. And the term passed into Greek as paradisos, meaning an enclosed park or a pleasure ground, referring to the enclosed parks and gardens of the Persian kings. That comes from Little and Scott's Greek-English lexicon. A further definition from them includes this, that the word was first used by Xenophon, and he was a Greek historian who lived from 431 to 352 B.C., and it was used by Xenophon always in reference to the parks of the person of the Parisian kings and nobles. It was termed as a garden or an orchard. And so Solomon is using it in the 10th century B.C., and we're able to track it way back into Persian to mean a garden that was utilized by kings as pleasure grounds and exclusively for them. And so what Solomon is saying here is that he is looking on the Shulamite as a pleasure ground. I hope you caught that. Now, the Greek term is transliterated into English as paradise, and you can see this word used in 2 Corinthians 12:4 and Revelation 2:7. Now, the Archaeological Study Bible on page 1041 notes the following under verses 12 and 13 of Song of Solomon 4. Under verse 12, we read that garden refers to a place of sensual delights and is an apt metaphor for the beloved's body. So you see how the metaphor is working out here. And being locked up, closed, and sealed are metaphors for the beloved's virginity. It's locked. She is a virgin. And she is to stay that way until a right man breaks the lock, who is the shepherd, not Solomon. So the message here to young ladies is keep the garden locked until the right man comes along with the divinely designed key. It goes on to read, the fact that she has kept herself exclusively for her husband is the important point here. Springs and fountains are sources of refreshment, metaphors for the beloved as a sexual partner. That's the springs and the fountains. And then under verse 13, your plants is a reference to all the beloved's features that delight the lover. That would be Solomon in this case, and that should read the potential lustful lover. Orchard comes from the Hebrew partis, the root of the English word paradise, a loan word from the old Persian language meaning enclosure or park. Now, if we go back to the metaphors, as we've seen in these two verses, then you can see he's not talking about a pleasure garden of the Persian kings, or that he even has one, which is quite possible, I would guess, but that he's speaking of the body of the Shulamite. Here's verse 20 with pickup line number 20. You are a protected virgin, my Jewess, my wife, whose womb is a locked garden, its spring of life sealed up within. And then we have verse 13, and let me flip here and read it in a paraphrase. Your physical pleasures are as a royal paradise full of pomegranates and choice fruits, the aromas of the henna's bride's flower and the nard's perfume. So we have to do a little work to get that far, but it gives you an idea that he is not speaking of your basic garden where things grow and are prolifically doing so. All of it is innuendo and metaphor. So these notes that we've just been through document that Solomon is using metaphorical language in his pickup line, which he is hopeful will excite passions and desires in the Shulamite. So here are the reasons for pickup lines that young ladies need to absolutely memorize. That what they say is designed to excite passions and desires in you because you are a natural responder and they are natural aggressors. And if you get a natural aggressor who is not a gentleman, a natural aggressor who is on the prowl, a natural aggressor who is not fortified with doctrine, then he is going to utilize whatever he can about your attributes. He will compliment you in every possible way, and most of it, if not all, will be true. But it is designed to break down your defenses, to think that he is a marvelous person to recognize all these wonderful attributes that you see in the glass, and that therefore he just must be Mr. Galahad. And so you're wooed by this. And this even extends over to other areas of life where people are trying to get you to make some decision that favors them, and they begin to compliment you in varied and sundried ways in order to lure you into doing what they want you to do. You're being manipulated. Now, whether it's a pickup line from some guy, or whether it's a business associate, or whether you walk into a store and they start giving you lines as to why you ought to buy something, it goes across the entire gamut of experiences. To beware of people who are telling you what you want to hear. And once they convince you that they're right and you're enamored by it and you respond to all of this, then they have their way with you in many varied and sundried ways. Economically, here we have romantically, but that's only one way it would occur. So be careful about people who overly compliment. So these notes document that Solomon is using metaphorical language in his pickup line, which he is hopeful will excite passions and desires in the Shulamite. And under normal circumstances, he has found that these things work for him. He's got 1,000 women that apparently were wooed by these kinds of things. And he's up against a woman now that's got doctrine, and she is a Jewess, and she apparently has been loyal to Yahweh Elohim. She has learned his word. She has examined the sacrifices. She understands that there is an ultimate fulfillment to those sacrifices in Jesus Christ. She believes in Him. She has His Word. And she has the confidence that that brings to her soul. And she is standing fast on the idea that the shepherd is her right man. And it says so in the context here that she is defending her garden. And she's been doing that. And we saw it even in the concept of the verse here. You are a protected virgin. She is protected because doctrine has done it for her. And under circumstances of an individual without doctrine, she very most likely would have followed the lead of the other 1,000 women. And Solomon is not used to being denied. So he is fixated on her sexual assets, which he refers to as pardes. The Hebrew word for pleasure grounds or marvelous garden, which is the exclusive domain of kings, which at the moment is sealed. He plans to unseal it. You have a fence around your yard. It has a gate somewhere. It's either that or pole vault over the fence. Get a good running start and do a broad jump. You know, those chain link fences can really tear up a shin. So you have to be careful about how you get into a garden or a backyard or what have you. There's always a gate. It's always easier to go through the gate. But when you come to the gate, you find the gate is locked. So how do you get into the gate if you don't have the key? You have to break the lock. So this is a case of Solomon committing mental adultery and then telling about it. He tells it. Mental adultery, and then he tells about it. So he's in a situation as a libertine where he just admits to being a sex addict. And he's driving home these pickup lines, and in essence he's saying, this is what I intend to do. And she's wise enough to pick up on it. The other ladies apparently were excited to hear all of this. And when he gets down, see, we're down to pickup lines in the 20s now. And he finally gets down into the 20s, and he's getting very personal. And it's usually about this time, I would imagine, that these other ladies were responding quite vigorously. And he probably didn't have to go past the early 20s with them. But he's only just getting started with this woman. So he's committing mental adultery and telling about it. He envisions her plush garden as a place of great productivity, which he intends to cultivate to satisfy his own increasingly excited passions and desires. You can see him breaking out in a sweat by now. He's wondering why these pickup lines have not worked as efficiently as they have in the past. And he continues to intensify as he moves through this. I mean, it's no longer about hair and teeth, you'll note. Well, Solomon compares the sensual pleasure he expects to enjoy with examples of fruits, spices, and oils which he enjoys. I mean, how are you going to define these things in terms of that being crass? So, you know, you're as sweet as the honey that drips from the hive. That's a nice way of phrasing things. And then, of course, the aroma of all of these pleasures is like henna blossoms. Well, there's a hidden meaning behind henna blossoms. We'll get that to that in a minute. I mean, everything is propaganda. It comes at you from every side. Everything he says is designed to convince her that it's all over. You're going to be my wife. So he was apparently very fond of pomegranates. That comes up in all of this. Your shoots are an orchard, mind you, of pomegranates. The very popular fruit, I have learned, in the ancient world, in Israel. He mentions them often. It was one of the most popular fruits in Israel. It was a bitter, sweet fruit that was used for sweetener and made into wine. I found this little blurb from the Pictorial Encyclopedia of the Bible under pomegranate. We have an entry here. Juice makes of a pomegranate. Makes a syrup called grenadine. I don't know if any of you ladies are familiar with grenadine. It's a syrup, and it can be used as a sweetener. You know about grenadine? Really, do you? It's widely known. I learned about grenadine today, but this is a very widely known sweetener. And it comes from pomegranates. Did you know that? See that? Yes. I say, yeah. Well, see, we have people that are experts in pomegranates here, and then possibly you do well with Solomon. He was very, very fond of this particular fruit. But it was used for making sherbets and wines, if you can believe that. It turns out that pomegranate wine was very popular in Israel in the 10th century B.C. And I'm convinced that that possibly is what Solomon is swigging on the couch as they're in the palace and in his quarters and as he is firing these pickup lines at her and says that she is more intoxicating than wine, he's probably got a little pomegranate sauce going there. Now, it's interesting. I don't know if you've ever seen a pomegranate. I have seen more than I would like to see. It looks something like this. That's really not good. Those of you who are experts in pomegranates already realize that. So let's try again. I'll try to do this part here. And then it goes up, and you have this little thing here. And it, according to Solomon, I guess that's where it comes off the tree. I don't know. But it has this little rise here with a jagged top to it, and it's circular like that. So it's sort of jagged around in a circle like this. So it's at one end of this pomegranate. Well, this is called a calyx, for those of you who are into botany. The circular calyx at the end of the fruits look like a little crown. They appear to be a little crown. And tradition claims that Solomon used it as a model for the one he wore. So see, he's a big fan of pomegranates. He probably likes to eat them. He likes the sherbet. He likes the grenadine. He likes the wine. So when he compliments her by comparing her with pomegranates, he's speaking of something he truly enjoys. You see this. Okay, I've worn that one out. Let's move on. You get the picture, though. Why always talking about pomegranates? He just loves them. And if he wants to compliment her, he say, man, you are as sweet as pomegranates. Be it wine or sherbet or syrup or grenadine. So again, we find Solomon colorfully describing from nature the vivid effect he expects from sexual experiences with the Shulamite. This is his Fancy Dan, slick-tongue way of complimenting her, that sexual experiences with her would be sweet and intoxicating, metaphorically speaking. Next, he speaks of her choice fruits. The word choice is the Hebrew megeth. It indicates a choice thing or the best thing, and is used figuratively by Solomon to describe her fruits, which he imagines will provide exotic pleasure derived from exploring them in her garden. So that's what we're getting out of this. And I hope you know that the Shulamite is not ignorant about the metaphors. She knows exactly where he's going, what he's got on his mind, and she's got to defend herself with a doctrine in her soul. I mean, you ask, well, what's the application here? I know you're speaking to the young people and trying to give them a defense department against these kinds of things, being nubile and all. But we see very clear applications to this in our daily lives. There are people out there with propaganda. And the propaganda is designed to get you to loosen your defenses and therefore agree to a brainwashing program. And the idea there's always something involved for that person who's complimenting, who's giving you what you want to hear. In other words, talking in line with your ideology. When some progressive, let's say, starts complimenting you about what a wonderful Christian you are, you need to run and run like the wind. They're up to something. So this idea of being propagandized comes through clearly here, although Solomon's subject matter has to do with trying to lure this lady into his harem. It also can take on other applications when anyone tries to lure you with any description of information, no matter what the subject would be. They're seeking to break down your defenses so you will buy into their idea so they can then use you to their advantage. You have to be very careful about that. And Solomon apparently was very good at its application in other areas, as we learn from Ecclesiastes. He sought happiness in at least 9 different categories there, sex only being one of them. And he was very successful in pursuing these things, except for the fact they didn't provide his happiness that he was searching for. Let's get to the henna shrub. Henna is a shrub whose blossoms are very aromatic and were known as the bride's flower. So now he's saying that she is as sweet as the bride's flower, henna blossoms. And the henna blossoms are said to be with nard, also translated as spikenard in some passages. And so nard is an oil taken from a North Indian herb and was used in making perfume, which we learn from Song of Solomon 1:12 is presently being worn by the Shulamites. So he's pulling out all stops to find anything by which to compliment her. Now, a paraphrase of verse 13 and pick up line number 21 reads this way. Your physical pleasures are as a royal paradise full of pomegranates and choice fruits, the aromas of the henna's bride's flower and the nard's perfume. Now, I've noticed here as we go through this particular couple of verses, especially with this word paradise and how it goes back to ancient Persia and how it was an environment in which the kings had their pleasure, you begin to see how this word, it also came into the Hebrew. It very possibly also went into the Arabic. And we find here possibly the root to the Islamic idea that once you die, you go to paradise. And in paradise, you have these virgins. We see this whole idea come out in this passage here. The Shulamite is a virgin. He defines that in metaphorical terms. And then he goes on to say that to enjoy the attributes of that garden is called paradise to him. So you pull all of this over into the Arabic field of thought, and you see how possibly they develop the idea of when you die, you go to paradise, this garden, that is populated apparently by an unending supply of virgins, each being issued 70 or 72, I can never remember which. And I don't know what kind of health these Islamic fellows are in, but according to their theory, once they die, they immediately transferred to paradise and issued these women, and that they will spend eternity in paradise with the assigned 72. Well, eternity is a good long while. And I just can't get that 72 is enough. I don't think they've thought that through. But nevertheless, that's their theory. Now let's move on to Song of Solomon 4:14 and pick up line number 22. And he's continuing with his description that he begins in verse 13. nard and saffron, calamus and cinnamon, with all the trees of frankincense, myrrh, and aloes, along with all the finest spices. Now, it must be remembered that the Song of Solomon is a piece of music. As we've gone through these pickup lines, you can see, first of all, that they don't very often blend into how we might phrase things today, especially if we're trying to impress some woman. The goats coming down from the mountains, I mean, that sort of topped it for me. But then there are others. But when you look at Hebrew poetry in the 10th century and understand that this was put to music, he was quite the musician. We've noted how many songs that he wrote, 1,005, I believe, if I remember correctly. He wrote all of these songs, and that means he put them to music. And that means that he was very well educated. I mean, to write poetry, you have to have a very broad vocabulary and an understanding of meter. And when you decide to tell a tale in song and poetry, the lyric as it were, then you have to have a very full command of your language and to understand meter, rhyme scheme, and have the vocabulary to express yourself and to then put it to music or vice versa. Some people write the music first and then do the words. Some people do the words and put it to music. And how Solomon did it, I don't know, but he got it accomplished in Song of Solomon. And so as he writes this, and we see things like this verse here, we think, well, why did he go on and on mentioning these spices? But you can listen to popular music today, and with the music, I'm thinking of truly popular music. I'm not speaking of the noise that's out there. The standards is what I would be referring to. I love the standards. You get Cole Porter and the Gershwins. Ira, and I forget the other one, George and Ira Gershwin, and Henry Cohen. Well, he wrote some magnificent stuff around World War II. He wrote Over There, those kinds of songs. When you put these things to music, a line that doesn't appear to be very powerful becomes powerful with the music. And that what I'm trying to tell you here is this verse here seemed like a throwaway line. But it's not if you can imagine it put to music. So that's not going to help us any, but it will help you understand that it's not really a throwaway line as the Shulamite hears it. So it's music, and we are presenting this as a teaching aid as if it were an opera. Now, as Solomon continues his description of sexual pleasures, he tries to mention every sweet-tasting, sweet-smelling item he can possibly think of. And she's hearing this, and she knows they smell nice and sweet and alluring, and she knows that the visual thing that he's describing is also there. They taste sweet, they smell nice, etc. And this all seems superfluous, but the lyric of an aria, when it's combined into a lyric, then the music becomes a well-crafted piece of propaganda. And if I were able to rattle off some things today that are sweet-smelling and sweet-tasting and put it to a proper rhyme scheme and then put it to music, and it was done in a way that was alluring to whoever likes music today, whatever genre it happens to be, then it would sound great put to music. And that's what I'm telling you this verse sounds like to the Shulamite. It seems superfluous, but the lyric of an aria, it combines with the music to become a well-crafted piece of propaganda intended to complement the Shulamite's physical attributes while concealing the king's hidden agenda, to enjoy her paradise physically rather than just singing about it. In other words, as Elvis Presley might say, a little less talk and a little more action. There is nothing in particular about any of these fruits and herbs that contribute anything further to our understanding of the passage. They are simply items that were in common use of that day. They have pleasant aromas that were often used to perfume the area chosen for lovemaking. I don't know exactly how that would go today. I don't think anybody slows down for anything like this, but you know, I can imagine rose petals and those candles that people put around the room and fire them up. You have all these odors and aromas going. That's the idea. He was into candles, I'll bet you. He was into rose petals and pomegranate. Probably had a pomegranate candle going. What do you think? I'm thinking he probably did. He's got the Shulamite on his mind. Now, rather than exegete this verse, we'll just mention what each of these items are and move on. I guess most of you are glad about that. Verse 14, pick up line number 22. Nard, and I'm happy to report that nard is perfume. It sounds nardy, doesn't it? But it's perfume. And saffron. Now, there are your dried flower petals, guys. These are the rose petals that people might use today. I don't know whether you... roses, petunias, whatever. Dried flower pistils and stigmas used as an aromatic. Calamus. This was a sweet-smelling reed. And cinnamon. A spice used as a perfume for beds. Solomon knew he had a manual. He had a, you know, sex for dummies. And you say, well, this is a throwaway line. See, I'm trying to show you here that this is not a throwaway line. Not to a woman that's responding to Solomon. Now, you note that the Shulamite is not going to respond to this, but she knows what he's talking about. Well, I read off that list of spices and herbs. That didn't move you. But think about knowing what these things mean put to music. Perfume, dried flower, pistils and stigmas used as an aromatic, a sweet-smelling reed, a spice used as a perfume for beds. You just thought cinnamon was good for toast. With all the trees of frankincense, myrrh, and aloes also used to perfume beds, along with all the finest spices. Put that to music. You see, it might have just a little lilt to it. Many of the things Solomon sings in his pickup lines have double meanings, as we've noted. They are designed to appeal to the Shulamite's approbation lust. See, I think you have pretty hair, you have pretty teeth, pretty neck, pretty forehead. Remember that one, the pomegranate forehead? You wonder, where did that come from? Well, he's into pomegranates. He thinks they're beautiful. If you got a forehead that looks like a pomegranate, you're good to go with Solomon. They are designed to appeal to the Shulamite's approbation lust, while at the same time stimulate her passions and her desires. And he has one more line left to fire in this aria. In verse 15, pick up line number 23. You are a garden spring, a well of fresh water, the streams flowing from Lebanon. He keeps firing Lebanon out there. Henna blossoms. You hear that? Bride's flower. Now he's reminded of the proposal to go to the mountain villas again. See, propaganda can use a word, just fire a word out there enough, define it at first, mountain villas, and then just throw it into the conversation along the way, and it vectors back to the original use, which is we're going on a honeymoon. And we're going to go to 5 different beautiful mountain villas, and we'll just prop up and watch the lions play. All put to music. Now in verse 12, Solomon sings about the Shulamite being a spring of life sealed up. The same word is used here in the phrase garden spring. Solomon then describes her as a well of fresh water and streams flowing from Lebanon. Now each of these speaks of life and life-giving power. Now you remember back when we first started this study and we got to talking about Solomon's motivation for having 1,000 women. And it was at least in that day, and it may exist in some parts of the world today, I don't know. But in Solomon's day, it was not uncommon for kings to have harems. And they did so because they had it in their mind that if they were to procreate wholesale by use of a harem, that their DNA would be scattered throughout the population, and since they were king and they were brilliant and their bloodline was superior to all others, that they could infuse the population with a large number, especially of men, with their DNA, that these guys would take up the challenge, and that they too would spread the DNA through the population. And that, in essence, would ultimately breed a very strong population, physically, mentally, even sexually, so that the power of the kingdom would be maintained over several generations. Well, we've got Solomon here admiring the youth of this woman, and that her garden is very, very prosperous. And that she probably not only could provide great pleasure in the pleasure garden, but also that she would be prolific and he could sire many children and thus spread the DNA. So each of these metaphors, well of fresh water, streams flowing from Lebanon, speak of life and life-giving power. Now this water flows from the spring and it collects in a well. And these waters illustrate the Shulamite's ability to procreate. Solomon knows this, and has so described her in verse 12, whose womb is a locked garden, its spring of life sealed up within. His intent is to unlock the garden and enjoy its waters as a means of refreshment by assuaging his libido. Again, he's got multiple objectives. So when the guy's firing lines, he may have several ideas. I can tell you what the top idea is a swayed libido. You're being used for his biological needs, first of all, and then you go from there. Now he refers to the waters as flowing from Lebanon. There's a vector going back to the mountain villas. And this is a reference then to the power of the rivers whose headwaters originate in the mountains of Lebanon. I brought the map, and I can show you a couple of sites that we're going to note here in explaining this verse. This one shows one of the rivers, which is the Latani. It comes down the Baca Valley right here and hooks a right-hand turn and goes into the Med just about 6 or so miles north of Tyre. And then over here, these are the Anti-Lebanon Mountains, and we're about to note another river that comes out of the mountains and flows northward, actually, into Syria. And so let's keep that up on the board, and you can see as we go through this where it all is. He refers to the waters as flowing from Lebanon, a reference to the power of these rivers whose headwaters originate in the mountains of Lebanon. Now, you've got snow on these mountains. I pointed this out to you. Lebanon means white. And it was named that because snow remains on these mountain peaks throughout the year. I found that interesting in the Mediterranean environment, and we looked at that. But the height of these go up well beyond 8,000 feet at the ultimate and average somewhere around 6,500. So you've got these white caps that come down through here. Now, in the summertime, they do melt. And when they do, they run down the sides of these mountains and into the Baca Valley here for the Latani River. And, of course, they melt up here to the north side into the Orontes River that goes into Syria. Now, here's what you have to imagine, that in the summer when these things start to melt, the mountainsides, put yourself in a very tight valley, the Baca Valley, and when these things start melting and water starts rushing down the sides of these mountains into the valley and collecting in this river, the Latani primarily, that the roar trapped between these two mountain ranges is a horseshoe arrangement. See, this one mountain range coming in from the north, and it splits into two prongs here. So the sound is trapped. And you can hear the roar of this water not only coming down the mountain, but engorging the river as it flows southward to the Med. Now, in the spring when the snow melts, the Baca Valley roars with the sound of the waters rushing into the rivers below. The Orontes River flows out of the anti-Lebanon mountains to the north of the valley and into Syria. That's not shown on this map, but it's in this general vicinity here, going northward as the snow in the anti-Lebanons melt. The Litani River collects the runoff of both mountain ranges for much of the Bekaa Valley, and the power of this water is a magnificent display of hydrodynamics. Now, you want to know water? Electricity is powerful, but you have no idea until you start dealing with water. And when you really get the impression that you need and the respect that you'll get for water, is observe what happens to the ocean during a hurricane. I had a friend down at Troy State. He was a professor of geology, and he was trained in his education, got his Ph.D. in geology from Mississippi Southern, which is in Hattiesburg, not too far north of the coast. And there were those during Camille that this was the monster storm that hit it past Christian, Mississippi, and it was a Category 5 when it hit. This thing they had last year down at New Orleans was only a Category 3 when it hit. It wasn't much of a hurricane, except they didn't have levees that could hold. The levees it held had been your normal Category 3 hurricane. This was a Category 5. When it passed over our hometown, it was a Category 2. I mean, this thing was huge. And when it hit the coast, it was better than 200 miles an hour. Now, there were these students from Mississippi Southern who decided to go down there and watch this thing from some kind of beach high-rise. It was like a 4 or 5 story condo kind of thing, and they rent the top floor, and they're going to watch the wave come in. Well, that wave was something like somewhere between 40 and 50 feet high, the storm surge. And I don't know if you've ever played Tinker Toys. These are little stick-together, stick-figure deals you can make things out of when you're a kid. That little condo, which they thought was made out of concrete, and it was much like a Tinker Toy house. Leveled it. And there were about 20-some of them, and they got to all die that night. But when you're looking at a wall of water that's about 50 feet high, and that's the wave coming in on the shore that night, that's water power. And that's hydrodynamics. And what you see when water comes down a mountainside, nothing to stop it but the bottom, and that's the river bed down in the Bekaa Valley, the Litani River. And it, by the way, in case you've forgotten, here's where the Litani hooks a right-hand turn and goes to the Med. It is this area here that the Israelis were trying to secure from Hezbollah. They wanted to go deep. They wanted to push them back behind the Litani River here. See, south of that's Israel. And that's what they were after, to get the Hezbollah out of this region and get them north of the Litani River. Well, that's what is being referenced here by Solomon. So the Litani River collects the runoff of both mountain ranges for much of the Bekaa Valley, and the power of this water is a magnificent display of hydrodynamics. Now, Solomon's implication is that the compatibility between him and the Shulamite is so harmonious that their sexual experience will be an explosion of unrestrained passions and desires being fulfilled to the maximum. In other words, hydrodynamics. This guy has no shame. Now, the phrase "streams flowing from Lebanon" is metaphorical for the woman's physiological response to the man's physical aggression. Not to mention that he uses Lebanon as a vector. See, this is what he plans to have going on at the villa. Song of Solomon, verse 15, pick up line number 23. You are a garden spring, a well of fresh water whose power is like the streams flowing from the Lebanon mountains. And a paraphrase would read this way. Your womb is a spring of life, a place of sexual refreshment, whose powerful response is like that of streams flowing down the Lebanese mountains. Now, I think we can safely say that at this point, Solomon's aria reaches its climax. He has exhausted his arsenal of pickup lines for the moment. And it gives the Shulamite a chance to get in a word edgewise. See, she interrupted him back in verse 6, and she interrupts again here. Now, Solomon fancies himself a ladies' man, but he is certainly not a gentleman. And that is the major failure of this man at this point in his life. He's been this way for a good long while. And his sexual lust, he actually has what they would call today an addiction. Let me tell you what an addiction is. An addiction is where you decide that you enjoy a behavior pattern. It doesn't matter what it is. It can be whistling Dixie. But you enjoy a behavior pattern. And you learn Dixie and you whistle it one day and you enjoy it so much you whistle it the next day. And then you begin to innovate from a bass. And you begin to put trills in there. And then you whistle in certain ways that sort of might give it a blues sound. And you just work on Dixie left, right, and forward. And you can whistle it. You can do blues, bluegrass, jazz. You can do Dixie any number of ways. You're expert at whistling Dixie and you facilitated this. And then you get around to singing it. And you can sing it blues, bluegrass, country, however you want it sung, you can sing it. See, that's facilitating a behavior pattern. And if you want to take this up, I assure you, you'll get good at Dixie after a while. Well, Solomon was not addicted to sex. He tried it out, he liked it, and decided he was going to keep on. And he just kept on. It kept on until he got 1,000 women in his harem. And he became very good at recruiting new members. And he is such an expert at this point that when he approaches the Shulamite, he's giving her lines that he's seen work very efficiently over the years. And he is going to be bewildered over the fact that she's not responding in the usual way to all of these wonderful concepts that he's developed. I mean, he's tried them out. I mean, I've got this book, this one that I thought I could use for this study, but I've been unable to find ways to convey it to you. But this guy's written a book about how to go to these bars and pick up women. It's almost like a how-to guide. And in there, there are procedures that you would actually go through to go in and find a woman whom you had never met before that night and have your way with her before dawn. How-to guide. And it's out there in case you want to subscribe. Amazon.com. And you can get this and it tells you exactly how to do it. And it seems that the playing field are bars, nightclubs, that kind of thing. But it could happen anywhere. It could happen at a wedding reception, I gather. But the environment in which he seems to place the activity primarily is in a bar or a nightclub. And you go in there and you have certain ways that you hold, you know, stand. You have certain lines that you begin with and certain things you say and don't say. Times when you speak and don't speak. Anyway, it goes on and on. So what I'm telling you is Solomon had a how-to guide too. In fact, he wrote it. He wrote it. And he had this thing down to the nth degree. He had it perfected. And he, a 1,000 woman veteran, is now up against this beautiful Shulamite. And the thing that keeps his expertise at this at bay is the fact she's got doctrine in her soul. It's the only thing, because he's been very successful. And during this time, he was not a gentleman. And so the Shulamite has the doctrine to discern the hidden agenda behind the compliments that he fires at her. These are the pickup lines. And remains a lady. Now, I'm going to note that the men of America have become so many Solomons. I want to stop here. Because we go into another area of our study at this point when we're going to discuss the problem of there being a dearth of gentlemen in the country. You go to the high schools today, the young men who attend there are not gentlemen, by and large. They don't know what being a gentleman is. So the ladies have to understand that when they go to matriculate at the local academies, that the young men there, not their fault necessarily. Everyone has to be trained in these kinds of things. If you're not trained, you don't know how to act. But it's not your problem. Your duty is to discern what's behind what's being said to you by these young fellows. There's a lot of good DNA out there, so there are a lot of stud muffins running around. You're going to find out what's in their souls. It's nothing but mush and goo. And you have to find this out. The physical appearance is not going to be the thing that you need to emphasize here. What's going on in the soul becomes primary. They are, generally speaking, they are not gentlemen. And when they begin complimenting, it is not because they're using their ability to discern your assets and then express their pleasure over this in a very congenial way. They're up to something. And so we want to begin developing on Thursday night the dearth of gentlemen in America, and that's where we'll pick up at point 12 on page 2336 on Thursday evening. Now, Heavenly Father, we are indeed grateful to You for giving us this opportunity to gather here to study these things and to discern from them so many applications in the 21st century A.D., and so it is our prayer You would motivate, encourage, and challenge us by these things as we lift our prayer in Christ's name. Amen.